On Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the holiest day of the year, the old high priest would perform his ablutions in the mikveh bath. And then, with the assistance of his attendants, he would adorn himself with the holy vestments. And trembling because he might make a false step or a slip of the tongue, he would carefully walk with the bowl of blood from a sacrificed bull into the inner sanctuary, the Holy of Holies. He would place the bowl on the altar, light the incense, and then pray the prayers begging for atonement for the sins of the people and the sins of himself. He would do this year after year after year after year. The preacher of Hebrews said, "Since we have confidence to enter the sanctuary by the new and living way opened to us by Jesus, let us approach with a true heart and in full assurance of faith." The first experience of failure I had in ministry came quickly, very quickly, as a matter of fact, only 30 minutes in. I had just graduated from seminary. It was the first morning of the first day in my first church, and I was in my office unpacking my moving boxes, taking out my commentaries and seminary textbooks and arranging them on the shelf behind my desk, when a woman, a member of the congregation, poked her head into the open doorway and said, "We're so glad you're here. Welcome." I said, "Thank you." Then she said, "Do you have a moment?" I lifted papers out of a chair and said, "Sure," and she came in and sat down. I recognized her. She was, as a matter of fact, one of the few members of the congregation I actually recognized at that point. She was a hard worker in the church and a loyal member, and she sat there and she started by saying how glad they were to have me as the new pastor, how everybody was looking forward to working with me, but I could tell something was on her mind. Then she drew a deep breath and she said, "I need to talk to you about something. I know I shouldn't feel this way. I don't even think it's Christian to feel this way. But I simply cannot shake the feeling that God would never forgive me for what I've done." I was 5 minutes out of seminary, and I handled it like the novice that I was. I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "I know my life, and I simply can't believe that God would forgive me for what I've done." "What have you done?" Well, see, that's the thing. In so many ways, she was just a conventional person. She hadn't committed any act of violence. She hadn't embezzled any money. She was faithful in her marriage, loyal to her church. She had raised two wonderful children. She didn't have any skeletons rattling around in her closet. I had had about this much training in pastoral counseling in seminary, but I tried it. It didn't work. Then I decided to try encouragement. Why don't you think about the good things you've done? You've done so much for the church, and think of your family and the children you've raised. That didn't work either. So I began to resort, only 30 minutes into my ministry, into what I swore in seminary I would never do: dispensing religious bromides and theological sound bites. "God loves you." "I know that," she said. "Jesus has forgiven you all of your sins." I know that too," she said, slumping deeper into the chair. I was adding to the burden, not relieving it. Out of options, I simply said at that point, I think this is the kind of thing we ought to pray over." And we prayed, but each of us knew that the prayer was more for my relief than for her healing. And then she left my office more burdened than before she came in. Years later, she and I had an opportunity to remember this conversation that took place on my first day in ministry, and I asked her permission to share it because I told her I had soon discovered in ministry that she is not alone. that in my congregation there were so many who stood there every Sunday singing the hymns and praying the prayers and shouting the alleluias and reciting the creeds and listening to the sermon and receiving the Lord's Supper, who felt like God knew everything about them and God could never forgive them. And the old high priest would go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, and he would pray for forgiveness for the sins of the people and for himself, year after year after year. Richard Finn has written a fascinating book about how it is that contemporary life puts all of us on trial. It's called Liturgies and Trials. He says, is it no coincidence that the earliest name for the evil one is Satan, the great accuser? And all of us are under accusation in so many ways. How'd you do on the SAT? You going to be able to make your first college choice, or are you going to have to fall back on your safety school? Son, how are your grades this semester? You're bringing them up? You think you might make a dean's list? How large is your church? Are you growing or losing membership? I think you're in a little tension there in the congregation. Aren't you going to make budget this year? Your first marriage ended in divorce? How are you at relationships, generally? How'd the tenure review go? You writing anything these days? I think maybe you are putting some pressure on your children. I'm noticing a little anxiety in them. Are you a good parent? You aren't scarring them, are you? You probably know about the study that was done of high-achieving, successful people, asking them about their fears. And the number one fear of successful, high-achieving people is that they will be found out, discovered to be the frauds that they know they are. They know their own lives, and they somehow believe that God, who knows everything about them, could never forgive them. And the old high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, and he would pray for the forgiveness of the people and the forgiveness of his own sins, year after year after year. Now, we don't know what the old high priest said when he was in the Holy of Holies. Only he could go in there, and only he on the Day of Atonement. But we may have a glimpse of what he may have said in Annie Dillard's memoir. Annie Dillard, the novelist and essayist, who took a writing sabbatical in the Pacific Northwest, and every Sunday, she said, she would go to church. There was one little church down in the firs in the valley, and she would go. The minister, she said, was a Congregationalist, and he led the service in shirt sleeves. And every Sunday, he would pray the prayers of intercession from the prayer book. One Sunday, she said, he was in the middle of the prayers of intercession. He had prayed for the hungry and the poor. He had prayed for peace. He had prayed for the lonely and the sick and the dying. And suddenly, abruptly, he stopped in the middle of the prayer, looked up into the air and said, God, we bring you these same prayers every week. And then, startled by what he had done, he went back to the prayer. Because of this, said Annie Dillard, I like him very much. I wonder if the old high priest, one year in the middle of the prayers for atonement for the sins of the people and his own sins, looked up into the heavens and said, God, I bring you these prayers every year. What do you want? What do you want from us? Do you want a cereal offering? Do you want the best lamb from the flock? Do you want the sacrifice of one of our children? What do you want? And God would have said, I want what I have always wanted. Humanity fully alive. Human life well lived. And like the woman who got up from the chair in my office that day, he would have trudged out of the temple more burdened than before, because that is the one thing we human beings cannot provide on our own. humanity fully alive, human life well lived. And that is why the preacher of Hebrews tells us that God, our mother and father, seeing that we were lost and broken, sent the Son to rescue us. And that is why the preacher of Hebrews takes us into the very inner sanctum, into the Holy of Holies, so that we can see the Son return. This is not the Holy of Holies made by hands. This is the one in heaven. And the Son returns and stands before the God who is our Father and Mother. And this time, we know what he said. He said, "Your name and mine. I am here," he said, "on behalf of these. I am not ashamed to call them my brothers and my sisters." Jesus, who was accused in every way as we are, who was placed on trial in every way as we are, who can sympathize with our weaknesses, who was tested in every way as we are, but without sin, stood there and said, "On their behalf, I give to you a human life well lived, humanity fully alive." And all of the accusers fled because they dread to hear in the ear of God what every parent who has lost a child yearns to hear when Jesus said, "I'm home and I have the children with me." Not long ago, I got into a little trouble with the law. What happened was this. My wife and I were going out to eat one night, and I needed to get gas for the car, so I pulled into a service station, filled up the car, and then I had to scoot across three lanes of traffic to a fourth turn lane so that I could turn on the interstate to go to the restaurant. Well, I watched the traffic and picked my spot, and when there was an opening, I scooted across the three lanes and into the turn lane. But just as I did, the light turned red and the traffic stopped, and I found the nose of my car in the turn lane, but the tail of my car in the next lane. So I waited for the light to change, but I looked into the rearview mirror, and so I pulled over into a parking lot, and the policeman came over. I rolled down the window, and he looked in and said, "Do you know what you did wrong?" "No," I lied. He said, "You were impeding the flow of traffic. When you're young, you get a ticket for speeding in a sports car. When you're my age, you get a ticket for being in the way." He went back to the car, he wrote out a ticket, and he brought it over, and he put it in the window to me. And by that point, I had collected my senses a little bit, and I said, "Exactly what law did I break here?" He pointed to the ticket, and he said, 16-4712A, you can look it up in any library," and walked away. Well, I'm a university professor, I looked it up in the library. Not only that, I looked it up in the law library. Not only that, I did a LexisNexis on it. And then I did a text critical analysis on the law. And on the basis of that, I decided I did not impede the flow of traffic. I did case law, I did precedents, and by the time I was done, I had a file folder an inch thick proving that I did not impede the flow of traffic. My wife said, "Tom, you're an idiot. Just pay the fine and be done with it." I said, "No, I want my day in court." And my day in court came. I was seated there in the courtroom. The bailiff came in. "All rise." We did. The judge came in. She sat down behind the bench. She asked us to be seated. She shuffled some papers around. And then she said, "Will Thomas Long please approach the bench?" I picked up my file folder and walked up to the bench. She leaned over the bench and said, "The officer who arrested you is no longer employed by DeKalb County. There is no one here to witness against you. You're free to go." Something in me rose up and wanted to say, "Hey, you can't just throw my case out like this." Because there's something in me that would rather be proved right than to be free. We are told that one day we will all stand before God. And I believe that what God will say to us is, you can put down your file folders. All your silly self-justifications are of no worth in here. And anyway, your brother, the great high priest, has already been here on your behalf. And look, there is no one here to witness against you. Welcome home. The feast is ready.